There's Tim.
Tim, good.
Give you a second.
Every time we do this, I keep saying this is a record only meeting, and then we keep breaking the record the next week.
Finally,
the chicken in the oven.
So what are we having for dinner?
But no, there's chicken and guests showing up at 5:30. So I just say, synthetic.
We'll get you out of here.
Well, the chicken has to be in at 4:30.
Oh, that's true.
Tell him he has to leave his job.
Well, you're not.
Is there enough for all of us?
The chicken's late.
Hey, Candace, is there enough for all of us? Because we've all, none of us has dinner plans.
You have dessert. You can take that home.
You know, I'm lucky. Last night, I had a little bit of strawberry ice cream.
Something's got to get hot, something's got to get cold.
Exactly.
All right, now that everything's rearranged, Mr. Chair.
Proceed.
We'll try to keep this brief and we'll keep it to the bare minimum. You feel free to pepper us with questions as you see fit, but this is a staff recommendation to make a commitment to Energy Investor Fund 5. We've been investors with EIF for many years in funds 1 through 4. This is a power generation and transmission private equity fund. Some of you might recall that we did a mapping of how to deploy private equity money and real asset money about a year ago. We did make the recommendation at that time that while we had classified Energy Investor Fund as a private equity fund historically, we were going to recommend a change to the real asset fund based upon the cash flow profile. They're building operating assets that are kicking off the current cash flow. These are real tangible
just a
assets.
Second. They're not here today, right? Or are they?
They are.
Oh, okay. Get this private thing or confidential thing down.
I highlighted on mine.
Yep.
Sorry.
We continue to fight that battle as well. So we're making recommendations that this would be an allocation from the real asset piece of our portfolio. Primarily, they'll be investing in natural gas-fired power plants with development and acquisition of existing plants. There will be some capture of renewable energy, power transmission, pipelines, et cetera, but basically everything around power generation is their thesis here. So we have the funds available. We're recommending a $50 million allocation. We have a current role identified for it in the portfolio. It's a long-term partner of ours, and the big changes from the EIF group that you see in front of us is the ownership structure. Ares acquired the EIF group about 9-10 months ago now. So we've gone through the vetting of that, and I'll let Chi-Chi touch on the high points here, but we want to keep this to bare minimum. We understand the at 3:30 in the afternoon we're going to keep this light, but just a quick run through.
Just a quick question. In acquiring EIF, did the EIF lose any of its lead managers?
No.
There was planned retirements associated with the acquisition. Nobody left unexpectedly.
What were the planned retirements, please?
John Bueller. Bueller. Had been Bueller? Yeah.
And who else?
Well, you went through that.
Client services person.
Boris?
No, he's the client services person.
Not John. Torres.
Why?
Not Torres?
Yeah. No.
Okay.
Do they still own the Crockett plant, or have they sold that?
You're stretching my memory because that was fun.
That was in the fund before.
They sold
before
it.
Before
I think
us,
they sold it.
That was fun.
It was in the map.
It's in the map. I know. I can't remember which map it's on, but it's in one of the two maps.
Because I was going to, if they still own it, and they'll give you a tour of it, it's really pretty amazing to see it.
Yeah, it doesn't, you know, it just says previous investment. It doesn't say whether they still
I
own
think
it.
They sold it.
Or they can go show you some of the wires hanging up the towers
heading south.
And are they still keeping the office over in Marin?
Yes, Mill Valley.
Mill Valley?
Yeah, they will still keep the office.
Okay, thank you.
So Ares acquired EIF late last year. And earlier this year, Ares further merged with Ken Anderson. So there's two organizational changes, and we are going to talk about that a little bit. When I look into these organizational changes, I look at from three perspectives. First of all, it's from the owner perspective, and secondly, from the employee's perspective. And the last one is from my personal own, my own experience. So for owner's experience, Aries, they really think energy and power market is a large market with a lot of capital requirement, but they don't have any expertise in these areas. So that's why they went out to acquire EIF and then Ken Anderson. So this is something they don't have. They are not concerned about the ownership change or the retirement of the founding generation because, you know, they are very happy with the current leadership of the team, the younger generation. So they are not concerned about that. Throughout my conversation with them, their mentality about this acquisition, about EIF, is at the good times, they can get 20% return. At the bad times, it's 8%. So we heard this good times 20, bad times 8. This is sort of their philosophy about this investment. Then from the employees' perspective, I talked to a lot of the employees personally. Many of them receive raises, bonuses, but they are also signed up for a long-term contract. So I think it will be hard for them to leave in the near future. Lastly, from my personal own experience, my dealing with the new organization has been an upgrade for me. The content provided to me is richer, same speedy response. I'm personally more excited about the merger with Ken Anderson because Ken Anderson is the number one MLP manager in the nation. So Ken will be able to bring a lot of the input market intelligence to EIF. So that's the organizational front. I would like to pause for any questions you have on that. So secondly is the story of the fund is really the natural gas, very cheap and abundant. It's going to replace a lot of the coal retirement. So if you look at, I don't know if you have the memo from staff, but the Fund 4 is launched at 2010. And if you look at the page 2, look at that power generation from the source. So a lot of the change really started right about that 2010. You can see the natural gas, the green line started to pick up, and the gray line of coal generation started to dip down. So that's right about the inception year of the Fund 4. And you look at page 3, EIF's funds evolving diversification, you will see in Fund 4, launched around 2010, they started to have a lot more investment in natural gas. So this is the firm that is that can adjust very quickly to the market dynamic changes. And next one, I'm especially excited about the yield component of this investment. So with this complete, you will complete the last budget of the private real asset. So you will have managers going out there exploring the world for the best oil and mine. Domestically, you will have EIF to generate consistent current yield in a very reliable North American power market. So we think that's a very important stabilizer in our portfolio. And then the risk, my real concern about this investment is the technology risk. Right now, a lot of people are talking about the battery technology that will reduce the demand of consumer from the power, the utility companies. So that's a potential risk. But right now, technology is not there yet. The battery you have serve as a backup. And also, not every state is as sunny as California. And also, keep in mind, Fund 5 will also invest in pipelines and transmission, which we will require a lot of them if we want to transmit power generated from wind and solar to the base load.
We make up for it because more people are plugging their cars in California.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. No, and you are transmitting it, and I was going to say a lot of us are looking more at the community choice aggregation as alternatives to PG&E, so that would require green energy coming from alternate sources as well.
Yeah, and I hear a lot of the discussions on how practical for us to be totally out of the grid, and it seems to me that it's very hard, you know, to be totally out of the grid.
So what's the horizon on the risk that you identified, the battery risk, in terms of what the goals of the fund are relative to when that risk might actually reach fruition, where battery technology, you know, Elon Musk invents a new battery every 6 months or whatever, and he finds one.
Investment tail end risk. This is a private equity fund, so it's got a 10-year life to it. It's the risk is not in years 0 through 5. 0 through 5, basically, it's page 2. We have electrical demand. The mix is changing. We want to be part of repowering away from coal, utilizing the natural gas that we have in the United States, and we have cheap access to. That battery risk, that's out at the tail end. So that's on the disposition side. It's a risk the board should be aware of. But it's quite a ways out there.
So on the J curve, it's out at the top of the J?
Yes.
Okay.
And lastly, you know, I want to apologize for putting this investment in this ambitious agenda today.
Yes, it's your show.
But if you look at that last page, there is a 10 basis point discount on fees for the investment period. This investment has 5 years of investment period. So 10 basis point in for 5 years is meaningful. Mm-hmm.
That's for limited partners who participate in the first close.
Right, and their first close.
Does that mean 1.5 goes to 1.4, or it's 1.6 going to 1.5?
1.5 to 1.4.
Okay.
So it's a $250,000 savings on management fee.
And the first closing is scheduled at the end of September, but I was able to talk to them and let them understand if we get approved.
How much have they raised for this fund so far?
They have not had a first close yet.
Yeah.
So they're just in the process right now. Are we one of the first investors in this fund then?
We would be. We would like to participate in the first close. Now, that's a great question for them. But, you know, what do they have soft circle? What are they in contract with at this point in time? But in the interest of time, should we go ahead and bring them in?
Yes. Okay.
More cookies.
Send these down here.
Oh, you've got them.
Yeah, I'm
all
one.
Got it. The ones you want, Scott.
Are those the macadamia ones?
Yes, Scott.
I already have
two. Here you go, buddy.
I had my share. There you go. Well, you get them all. There we go.
Vote goes in court. I'm assuming
that.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I don't see
that. I didn't want to take a break. I could have waited.
Per annum. What are you going to do?
Yeah, but we're going to come in.
I think that's a hard
way to test them.
Good
one.
Yeah. I'm not a calculator.
Yeah.
They stopped at me.
Yeah. Taking you back to your old accounting days.
$350 and the attorney would be $5,000.
Just hit that.
We're doing accounting here in a little bit.
No.
Oh, okay.
Need a cookie, see Scott.
Jerry's got all the cookies, but he'll give you one if you'd like.
Must have finally given up, huh?
Some sort of settlement, how legal.
Oh. They're ridiculous.
Oh, thank you. I just need one.
It's ridiculous.
Let's pass these that way. And we'll take these and send them this way.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But you're going to pay a $7.
Yeah, they get you.
What happened to Tim?
Yeah.
You going to introduce him or they can introduce him?
Oh.
Email on the phone.
Trying to stay away. Poor guys.
I couldn't even eat my sandwich. I was so full. I got like a huge
Thought we could get you in early. We thought it was going to be later.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, sorry.
Oh, no problem.
Much on the docket today.
How'd you spend your day when the first 8 hours were in the living room?
I have a swing shift to go to later. So I'm
in there.
You are. You just don't play by the rules, do you?
My dad's here, and the former CEO's gone rogue.
Right. I'm so horrendous. He thinks whatever I do is golden.
Maybe she minimized. I'm sure he did.
Right. As a thank you for waiting, and this is unusual in terms of how late it is taken to get to your spot in the agenda. Appreciate you being here. There is a clause, confidential, not for publication or distribution. These are public meetings. Are you comfortable waiving that?
Yes.
Thank you. If you would each introduce yourselves and then go forward with your presentation.
I'm Herb Magid, one of the founders of Energy Investors Funds in 1987, and partner and co-head now of the group, and happy to be here. And this is...
I'm Keith Derman. I'm a partner at Ares EIF. I work in our New York office, sit on our investment committee, and have been with the firm for over 10 years.
Well, thank you all for taking the time to see us, and no need to apologize on the wait. We have lots of pension funds and police and fire funds, and know that sometimes business runs longer. In an effort to keep it short, we're going to move quickly through this, and so feel free to raise your hands if you have any questions or if things aren't clear. But first, as one of the founders of EAF, I wanted to take the opportunity to thank you all for your support over many years, and we very much appreciate the continued support. So we'll start on page 5, the executive summary. Again, we have a 28-year track record. We have 40 employees who are dedicated full-time to the business of investing, managing, and liquidating the funds. We also have operating partners that are exclusive to us, which add another 60 to 70 people. So there's over 100 people working on your behalf in this one strategy, which is really to invest in the U.S. in power, electric power, electric transmission, and gas and fuel transportation. And that has been our strategy since we started and continues to be. We invest in operating projects where we can add value, and also at the early stage of a project, just when it's getting its permits and it has its site and really going to start construction, we manage the construction and then the operations, and then we sell. So really a barbell approach where you'd have kind of a lower teens return on operating and a mid-20s on the projects that you get in early on, which gives us that high teens net return that we're targeting. The opportunity that we're seeing in my career, which is about 30 years in the power space and energy, for our strategy, this is really a unique time, and we'll talk a little bit more, Keith will, about it, but it really can't be missed that the uniqueness of this time is terrific for what we do, because you have a tremendous restructuring of both the power and the midstream energy sector. We are going through a combination of closing 100,000 megawatts of coal which is equal to the United Kingdom's total capacity, and being replaced with renewables, but mostly natural gas-fired power plants, which is what we do. And then connecting all these new gas supplies to the markets with lots of pipeline opportunities, again, what we do, point-to-point wholesale transmission. So for us, it's a much greater universe of opportunities. And as we talk about, you'll see that Fund 5, which is the fund we're talking about, is already about 20% committed. And at first closing, you'll be able to have a nice mini portfolio of
assets. How much is that right now, 20% of what?
We've committed $150 million to an operating power plant called Linden, which is cash flowing and will close next week. And then about a similar amount to a project that will go into construction in November. And both of those, the $150 million is through a guarantee by Ares Management, our parent, and it will really flip right into the fund at first closing.
How many other public agencies have you got that are investing in this fund right now?
How many other? Well, we haven't had a first closing yet, so the answer is none, of course.
So we're going to be the first then?
Oh, no, at the first closing, we'll have, right now, groups like John Hancock, which isn't a public agency, a number of foundations. On the top of my head, I couldn't guarantee that there'd be another public pension fund at first
closing.
How much
are you shooting for on your first fund? How much are you shooting for at the close of your first, at the first closing? How much money?
The target for the total fund is $2 billion.
Okay.
So the first closing, we expect to be between $500 and $1
billion. Thank you.
Sure. So that's our story on terms of, the team, the strategy. You know us well. So the new thing since we last presented is that Ares Management acquired our company on January 1st of this year. And you've done extensive due diligence on Ares, and we really believe that they add a lot of value to who we are and what we do. A much stronger team, just in kind of the compliance, accounting, but also on credit support and things like that. But from a day-to-day perspective, you wouldn't see any difference. It's all 40 of us moved over. We all have employment agreements. We're all excited. We all vest. So kind of the things that you would worry about in terms of alignment of interest are there. Page 6 just shows you the groups that Ares have, and we slot into the private equity group. And then the next slide is really just to remind you, because energy can be most everything in the world to everybody, and we're a very specific subset of that energy world. And we focus on, the downstream sector, which is electric generation, transmission, contracted assets mostly, and also in the midstream space, which is more the gathering, again, which have long-term offtake agreements. In that entire box, our goal is to mitigate commodity risk. So, for example, if you're in the upstream space, where you're investing in the exploration and production of gas, your returns and your fair market value are going to be much more tied to the price of oil or gas. And for example, between June 30th of last year and the end of the year, oil went from $100 to $50. A lot of fair values of upstream funds, were cut in half as well. The average fair value increase of our funds was over 20%, kind of unrelated to commodity prices. So the point is really, if you're invested in upstream assets, this is a nice balancing, and while in the energy space, really not that dependent on energy prices. So the other thing we wanted to highlight on page 9 is exactly what we just talked about, is the first investment in the fund, which is Linden Cogeneration Facility, a 943 megawatts, so a big, important infrastructure asset in New Jersey, sells power by a transmission line into New York City, provides steam to the largest refinery on the East Coast. So it's a core infrastructure asset that has been there for a long time and will continue to be. There's expansion and development opportunities, and it's a nice cash flowing asset that will provide a modest distribution probably by the end of the year. So exactly what we say we're going to do in terms of operating assets and balanced with our construction asset provides a nice portfolio fit. The next page, page 10, really 10 and 11, just talks a little bit about our construction equity pipeline, just to give you a sense that there's a lot of opportunities that we currently control that really fit our strategy. Keith is going to mention a couple of them. And even in a world that's always competitive, we control through development funding and prior funds and relationships enough equity to really fill out a $2 billion fund. Of course, we'll be investing in operating assets as well, but because we fully committed Fund 4 already, the prior fund, essentially maybe overcommitted, I guess, we have a good window onto the fund and likely rapid deployment of capital. The next page is another way of talking about it, converting small development dollars into large construction investments. So you're taking $141 million of development investments. So this is over all of our funds, and you're creating almost $4 billion of opportunities for co-invest and for investment. And those are valuable assets to own. We recently sold in Fund 4 an asset even before we started construction to a utility. So, they're fairly liquid and good opportunities. And just in case, there was some question about the risk profile on development, and we're only talking about taking maybe 5% or less of a total fund, but this is just a snapshot of our total track record on page 12, where you can see that realized investments that came through our development funding at a 40% IRR and a 2.3 multiple, the unrealized, so the deals that we currently have but haven't sold yet, 2.6 and 22, so very respectable returns that balance the portfolio. And as a total kind of check on what your loss ratio is, we've invested $352 million over the course of the U.S. Power Fund series and have already received back about the same amount. So even though you have a couple of losses of small dollars in there, the total return on your development funding is a good investment. So I know that was one of the questions that we have been asked to address. So with that, we'll move right along, and I'll let Keith talk a little bit about the market.
Thanks. Page 14 is where I'm going to start off, and as Herb alluded to, really just a fantastic time to be investing in the U.S. energy sector today. The power sector and also the midstream sector is undergoing just remarkable and almost massive upheaval. Over about a five-year period between, say, 2015, 2020, we're expecting just a little bit short of 100 gigawatts of generation capacity to be retired. To put that in context, California is probably about 65 gigawatts. This is the amount of capacity the entire United Kingdom fleet is in a five-year period disappearing. It's mostly coal plants that are going away, but it's also nuclear plants like San Onofre in Southern California. Why are these going away? Well, the primary reason is because of natural gas. Shale gas revolution, hydraulic fracturing, natural gas is abundant and low cost, and frankly, coal just can't compete, and even the nukes really can't compete. And so these plants, which have viable lives for another 10, 15, 20 years, are just uneconomic, unprofitable, and they're being retired. And so historically, our investment thesis has always been around building new power generation plants or electric transmission lines to meet the growth in the economy, population growth, GDP growth, et cetera. And that's been a great business model for us. But right now, we're in this really unique period where that's the proverbial icing on the cake. And we actually have a sprint, frankly, as a industry to backfill that supply that's disappearing. And we've been very, very actively involved in that. That's a easily $100 billion investment opportunity. Then when you layer on just the other natural retirements of an aging infrastructure, generation plants, et cetera, you start talking the numbers in the trillions over a 20-year period of new investment opportunity. And for a firm like us that's as active in development and construction as Herb mentioned, just really a great time to be investing. Turning to page 15, to give you one example of our deal flow, and as you can imagine, the deals that we're doing mirror the investment climate and the trends that we see in the sector. Well, we've been developing a new power plant in the state of Indiana, about 100 miles, about an hour from Notre Dame's campus, northern Indiana. It's called the St. Joseph's Energy Center, and we expect to start construction on this plant in November. It'll be about a $200 million equity commitment from Fund 5, which in combination with Linden would have $350 million of capital committed out of a $2 billion fund very, very early in its life. And what's so exciting about this project is that there's probably no state, and it's sort of in sort of a sneaky fashion, there's probably no state in the United States that's more dependent on coal than Indiana. It's the only state in the country that is in the top five of coal generation, both in actual use and percentage of the generation. They just haven't sort of picked up on what the rest of the country has realized, and that's the low cost efficiency of natural gas. There have been about 4 gigawatts of retirements in Indiana, and there's only one other power plant being built in the state, and no plants being in development.
Out of curiosity, where's your natural gas going to come from for St. Joseph's?
We sit actually on 2 major interstate pipelines, one owned by NIPSCO and one owned by Vector.
And where do they come from?
It's going to come from the mostly from the Marcellus and the Utica shales.
Thank you.
So really attractive investment opportunity for Fund 5. Again, we've got 2 deals that are so near term in the fund life, and it's pretty unusual for us to be able to start construction on an investment so early on the fund life. It's about 2.5 years to build one of these plants, about $750 million in total costs. For Fund 5 to have the benefit of owning that asset for so many years after it's built is a real positive. Page 16, I know we're going quick, another a little bit earlier development stage natural gas-fired power plant, this one located in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania is sort of ground zero in many respects for some of the changes in the power market, because you have more natural gas production taking place in the Marcellus Shale in Pennsylvania than really anywhere else in the country. And you also have, like Indiana and many of the states in the Midwest, substantial coal plant retirement. This plant's being developed in the eastern portion of the state, so it has good access to Philadelphia and some of the other more densely populated parts of the Mid-Atlantic, where you actually have higher energy pricing, higher power pricing.
Question for you.
Please.
What's the permitting and construction timeline, sort of soup to nuts, for one of these plants that's going to be a natural gas replacement plant, say in Indiana or in Pennsylvania? Is it like 3 years, 5 years?
Very different than California.
Yeah, that's what I was asking. I'm just curious what the regulatory climate was.
Yeah. In Pennsylvania, this plant, particular plant, because it's 400 megawatts, is below a certain permit threshold that it actually can stay with the state, with the DEP, as opposed to going to the EPA. You're probably talking, for the permitting, the air permitting and the water permitting, you're probably talking about 18 months, and then a construction schedule about 2.5 years. The timeline around the actual interconnection, literally the plug-in of the plant to the transmission system, is probably about 2 years, 1 to 2 years, depending on what else is around you. Indiana's pretty comparable, probably about 2 years for the permitting, and then about 2.5 years for construction. California, we're building a power plant in San Diego in USPF 3 called Pio Pico, which is going to be a very, very successful investment for all of us. It got caught up in some substantial regulatory challenges at the CPUC. We actually did great through permitting through the California Energy Commission, but we had some real challenges at the CPUC, but ultimately got the contract approved, and that plant's being built and should be online summer of 16.
So in some of these other venues, whether it be Pennsylvania, Indiana, you can scope the size of the project, either fall within or get around a particular threshold that might actually make it go faster or stay out of a particular permitting regime?
Well, because we've been doing this as long as we have, we always pick developers, right? Because Herb and I aren't out there actually on the ground doing the permitting ourselves. We pick developers that are experienced, and we do our due diligence on making sure that the state is supportive, the community is supportive, that the location is permittable. We've seen enough of the sort of the bugaboos of what can take a project down that we're not always right, but we're usually right. And so it's often a question of when and not if.
And to clarify, it may take 2 or 3 years or less to permit a plant. It doesn't mean that we always invest at the start of that permitting. There's often opportunities, and we try to find them, where developers have spent their own money, a few million dollars, to get it to a point where they're 6 months away from construction, or they just need a letter of credit, or they need, you know, the presence of us to sign a contract to build it. So, you know, a lot of times our investment, you know, window is maybe a 6 months to finish development, and then the 2 years for construction.
Yeah, I'm just trying to get a feel for what kind of permitting risk you take on versus sure. coming in later, as you point out. So I guess you do both,
right.
Sounds like.
That's right. And if we do come in earlier, we just put in a little bit of money, right? It's a little bit of money, just enough to keep the project going until we see it getting de-risked. So that there's sort of a curve that goes like that. But if you look at our Newark Energy Center project, which is a natural gas combined cycle project, where we are finishing construction literally this week, it's owned by USPF 4 and USPF 3, which are obviously investors in both. We came in, to Herb's point, Hess had been developing it for almost 5 years. We came in 3 months before the start of construction. Well, that's Newark, New Jersey, so we wanted to be we didn't want to start developing that for 5 years.
Yeah, makes sense. Thank you.
Page 17, back to the shale gas revolution. This is really everything. The environmental regulations are significant. That's certainly putting pressure on coal, but the amount of production of natural gas, it's changed everything, and nothing will ever be the same. Natural gas is essentially the killer app in the U.S. power sector. And, of course, all this gas and oil as well has to get to market, and it's coming out of ground in places where it didn't used to come out of the ground. And so the E&P companies need to get that fuel to market. The E&P companies have always considered midstream, the pipelines, to be non-core. They've traditionally built them out and maybe sold them. Now they just don't have the money to build them out. And so it's a great time for us as a experienced developer and constructor of new projects to to be able to provide that capital, and we're finding really, I think, great deal flow in that area. Page 18 is an example of that. The Mead pipeline, which is a portion of a larger gas pipeline being developed by Transco. We own, I believe, about 20% of this project. We expect it to start construction in a year. But this is a simple business model. There is substantial gas in the Marcellus being produced. It needs to get to the cities on the eastern seaboard. And this is a contractual opportunity. And so the risk we're taking is around the permitting and development. Pennsylvania is a very supportive regime for this. This is jobs and taxes in Pennsylvania. And we're real excited about Mead. Page 19, the commodity cycle. You know, Herb referenced this earlier. The nice thing for us is that with oil prices where they are, it almost has had no impact on our portfolio. So for USPF 2, 3, 4, the impact of oil dropping from 100 to 50 to 40, back to 50, it doesn't matter to us. The U.S. power sector doesn't use oil to make electricity, except in a few hours a year in the most extreme of circumstances. But it's a real opportunity, as I said before, with the E&P companies being capital constrained. Turning to page 20, just really the final example of one of the deals in our pipeline, the Pilgrim Pipeline. This is a liquids pipeline that will bring Bakken crude from Albany, New York, down to Linden, New Jersey, and then actually also bring refined products from Linden back up to Albany. It's about $1 billion project, about $200 million of equity. It's very possible that this will stay in USPF 4, but importantly, there are a number of expansion legs that we're beginning to develop, which would likely be in Fund 5. But this is a perfect example of an energy infrastructure project which makes sense and is not dependent on oil prices. You're trying to get oil off of the rails, which is dangerous. We've seen all sorts of examples around explosions, trying to get that sort of volatile Bakken crude to market on the trains, and also getting it off of the barges in the Hudson River.
Keith, if New York was to change its rules on shale production, would that increase the value of this?
It's an interesting question. It depends on what they find. If they were to find, if they were finding wet gas, so more sort of oils, then yes, because you would have a opportunity to bring it down from Albany down to Linden. If there was more of a drier sort of true natural gas, maybe less so.
Okay. Any chance of that happening? A political chance, obviously. That's
That's a good question. Cuomo's really dug his feet in here, so I it doesn't feel that way. I think I just don't know. Probably not.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, well, let's discuss track record for a minute, and then we can conclude. Page 22, we have our historical footprint, U.S., see heavy California, Midwest, Northeast, not much in the upper Midwest, and that's probably going to continue, maybe a little more in the Midwest, but this is the type of kind of diversification geographically you could expect. We added a California slide just to show over the course of our history the significant investment on page 23. In all forms of really power, transmission, biomass, gas, landfill gas, and in California, so we know the state well. We've certainly found there to be a number of good solid investments, and we continue to look at assets in California. Page 24 is our U.S. Power Fund track record. which are the funds that have the same consistent strategy as U.S. Power Fund 5. Looking on the far right, you see that, you know, the targeted returns for all of the funds, including the results of Fund 4, Fund 1 of 1.9, are all in that, you know, 1.7 to 2 range on a net multiple and higher than that on a gross. Our target for Fund 5 is 15 to 17% net with a 1.75 to 2 times net multiple. That's well supported by the returns to date in Fund 4, which is the fund, you know, we point to as having the most consistent kind of financial kind of metrics as we're seeing today. Funds 2 and 3, which were 2005 and 2007 vintages, certainly have top quartile multiples. They've had very high yields, as you can see in the middle of the chart. Fund 4 is averaging 11.5%, and 2 and 3 in the 7 to 11% range, which really shows that these assets have a significant cash component that mitigates the risk, builds multiple, and, you know, a certain amount of capital appreciation. Funds 2 and 3 suffered from probably two main things, I would say. One is the precipitous drop in both natural gas prices. If you remember, we were starting to import natural gas. We were at $7, $8, $9, $10 expectations of much higher. So when you made investments like we did in coal and some of the renewables that after their contract life would be their residual value, if you will, because these are long-lived assets, would depend upon how competitive they were versus natural gas, you would see that a coal plant, like we're talking about, which when coal prices actually went up and natural gas prices went down by five times, you know, inevitably that residual value you're looking for is going to be less. And that's what you're seeing in terms of an impact on the IRR. The other critical thing when you think about returns in 2 and 3 were they took longer to invest. And they were invested during the 2008 financial crisis. So a good example is in California, having an approved power contract. Well, that got delayed because demand went down. So the two kind of major factors that impacted returns on the fund, incremental demand, slowdown of financial, and precipitous drop of gas prices from $10 to now $2 to $3 to $4, are really not existent in Fund 5. And actually, if gas prices go up and energy costs go up and inflation goes up, they're good hedges against that and they'll improve. So that's why we feel very comfortable about, you know, the 15 to 17% net, and certainly the first two investments in Fund 5 support that.
What's the biggest single risk to Fund 5? You know, if you could identify one thing that if it occurred would be a little bit of a showstopper, what would that be?
Well, you know, the biggest kind of risk we take is operating risk, but that's an individual asset basis because we're trying to not take commodity risk and we're trying to not take throughput demand risk. So
it sounds like the idea is you're going to replace facilities, at least part of the
right
plan is to replace facilities where the demand already exists.
That's right.
So you're stepping in and just you're going to be able to harvest that because you're not having to worry about new demand, right?
Right. So the biggest kind of macro risk would tend to be a dramatic change in the market for your product. Would there be in the next 10 years some game-changing technology which makes what you produce not profitable, not efficient? And, you know, that's a very minor risk. Regulatory risk, it could be another one, but we already are in a world where there's strict environmental controls and cost of carbon, and that's all factored into your models. So, you know, the macro side of it seems to be a very, very, you know, small downside, and I think where on an individual asset basis. You know, the risk that we worry about is just the operating risk, something happening that you can't control that causes you not to be able to produce electricity, which causes you or, you know, not to be able to make money, and you have a short-term, you know, impact on the cash flow. But typically on a long-term basis, it doesn't, you know, you have business interruption insurance, you have replacement cost insurance, you have all those things. But that's really why over 30 years we've been able to have a very, very low loss ratio and very consistent returns.
Is it cost effective to retool, say, a coal plant into a gas plant? You know what I mean, to run the gas to it?
So, sometimes. if you just actually run the gas through the boiler at a coal plant, the answer is no. Because the efficiency of doing that is very, very low. So, you know, some utilities are doing that because it's actually still more economic than burning coal at certain times. But generally speaking, you're talking about making electricity at something like that. It might cost $50 for a megawatt hour when a new gas plant could do it for, you know, 25 or 30.
So it's cheaper to build the plant then.
It's pretty much cheaper to build it. There are some instances where in certain locations, if the plant is in good enough shape, you might want to take some of the infrastructure. So we have a plant in southern New Jersey, and New Jersey's sort of like California, where it's tough to site new energy projects, new generation. This plant, you have a steam turbine that you might want to reuse and then bring in a new gas turbine. And then you get almost all the way to the efficiency of a new gas plant, but not quite. And you take sort of a trade-off in that efficiency versus the capital costs and site power. So,
well, there aren't any other questions. I'll just conclude by reiterating that, you know, for the last 20 years, this really is a great time for us to invest. A lot of the macro risks we're seeing with, where in the past we had high gas prices, are now upside. Really a replacement story, not an incremental demand story. All 40 of our professionals moved over to Ares, and we're excited about it. We're all locked into the program long term. We didn't mention the terms of the fund, which I think you guys know, but very LP friendly. The cost of this fund is lower than it has been in the past. There are first closing discounts, kind of following the Ares model. Actual team is committing directly $10 million of the people, you know, us and my 10 partners. So we're very much aligned. We're excited about the fund. We've already committed a good portion of it, and we expect it to be very successful. So thank you for your time today and support over the years.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Got a risk-free investment. We finally heard one.
Any questions of our guests? All right.
Thank you. Thanks for your patience,
Brian,
guys.
Yes. Yeah, I remember you went to the coal plant in Crockett years ago.
The gas plant.
Yeah, the EIF plant.
We used to own that plant.
Yeah, he went to it years ago when we first got in the first fund.
Walked into the sugar plant by mistake, didn't you?
No.
It's next door.
The CNH plant.
The steam they generated from the
what?
The steam they generated from the gas-fired electric
went to CNH.
Yeah,
that's surprising. A lot of those cogeneration type facilities. They could take some of this steam out of this board.
Sure, recommending a $50 million commitment, which is
motion to